Without any further ado, it's a pleasure to introduce dear colleague, Dr. Wafa El-Sadr. Dr. Sadr, many of you know as a global leader in the fight against HIV/AIDS and director of ICAP at Columbia University, where she's a professor of medicine and public health. Wafa also was a frontline clinician at the beginning of the epidemic, leading the effort to organize activities at Harlem Hospital in New York City. At present, she spends a good deal of her time working on the HIV Prevention Trials Network, but is also very active in clinical trials related to HIV, TB, maternal child health, and broad health system strengthening. So without further ado, Wafa.
Hi. Thank you very much, Ken, and good morning, everyone. Okay, I'm going to get started by giving you a little bit of a framework for where we are in terms of the state of the art for prevention. A mouthful. I think for starters, when we acknowledge, we need to acknowledge the achievements that we have accomplished, all the people in this room and many others, particularly in the countries, middle and low income countries, in terms of increasing the scale up for HIV treatment. As you can see here, over the past decade, the numbers of people who are having access to antiretroviral therapy has increased substantially, reaching by the end of last year, more than 8 million individuals. There's also been remarkable impact in terms of the lives of people living with HIV. And if you can see here from this figure, these are the numbers of mortality per 1,000 adults. And this is looking at death in PEPFAR-supported countries in Africa. And with the establishment and funding through this mechanism, there's been a substantial decrease in terms of overall mortality. Now, you can contrast that with death in other countries in Africa. So certainly the investments in terms of scaling up of HIV treatment has had a remarkable impact. And it's not just from PEPFAR alone, but also through the other mechanisms, for example, the Global Fund in particular. However, we know we have a long way to go. And this number keeps changing. An earlier slide I had this year had 6 million additional people who need treatment. But as we know, with new guidelines and more ambitious targets that have been set globally, now we have huge numbers of individuals, if we are to reach the targets for treatment, that will need access to antiretroviral therapy. So this is a huge task that needs to be accomplished by the global community. However, at the same time, we also recognize there are millions of people who are getting newly infected with HIV, estimated to be about 2.5 million individuals per year. And therefore, for people like most people in this room who do treatment largely most of the time, this reflects about 7,000 new infections per day. We've heard this again and again, this meme, that we can't treat our way out of the epidemic. And we've heard this for the past decade repeatedly, sort of as a criticism for the focus on treatment and for the investment in scale-up of HIV treatment. However, over the past decade as well, there's been accumulating evidence, as you all know, in support of ART for prevention. This came through ecological data, through observational studies amongst discordant couples, through modeling, and you heard about modeling yesterday, and of course, most critically, through HPTN-052, which demonstrated the efficacy of ART for prevention in heterosexual discordant couples. And I think it was the mix of all of this evidence that galvanized the global community to try to really address the issue of what is the potential for ART for prevention, what are the unanswered questions, and how can we move this agenda forward as we're focusing on both ART for treatment as well as ART for prevention. So now we are saying, now the meme is, we can treat our way out of this epidemic. But can we? And how can we do that working together and keeping in mind, again, the dual benefits of ART for both treatment and prevention? The major challenge in thinking about ART for prevention is we always, most of us, only see the tip of the iceberg when we see the people with HIV who come to the clinics, who get tested, and who come to our services. And if we are serious about increasing access to ART, both for treatment of the individual as well as for prevention, we have to be very concerned about the rest of the iceberg, what lies below the surface of the water, which is the majority of individuals. And this is the genesis of the HIV continuum. And what people have noted is that in order to reach, to achieve the goals of ART for prevention, one has to pay attention to the HIV continuum, meaning we have to expand HIV testing as much as possible to try to identify every single individual who is HIV infected, link those individuals to HIV care, engage them in care, pre-ART care, retain them in care, and then determine their eligibility for antiretroviral therapy, initiate antiretroviral therapy, but very importantly, retain them and counsel them and monitor and support them to remain on ART in order to achieve adherence and viral suppression, which is ultimately what we want to achieve for individual benefit as well as for the goal of prevention. However, there are many challenges in achieving the potential of ART for prevention. I'll walk you through some of them because I think they inspire what I believe should be a future research agenda in this topic area. I think they can be categorized, the challenges, into the following categories. The major one is unawareness of HIV status, and I'll tell you some of the data and some of the advances over the past several years. Late diagnosis of HIV disease, something that was touched upon yesterday. The failure in linkage and retention in care. Late initiation of antiretroviral therapy, even in people who are ART eligible. And lastly, the inability to achieve and maintain viral suppression for the duration of life of people living with HIV. So how have we been doing in terms of HIV testing? And here we have some good news. And this was mentioned a bit yesterday, and these are HIV testing data from Kenya, from KAIS, the preliminary findings from last year's KAIS 2012. And this is a survey that's done on a sample of the population in Kenya. And you can see here between 2007 in yellow and 2012 in purple, substantial increase overall in HIV testing in this age group. And obviously more even impressive amongst women. What's even more interesting, if you compare in 2007 to 2012 and look at amongst people who were found to be HIV positive through KAIS, through the survey, how many were aware or unaware of their HIV infection. And in 2007, 84% of those found to be HIV infected were actually unaware of their HIV infection. They either had never been tested or reported that they were negative. On the other hand, in 2012, in Kenya, there have been substantial progress. And now, of those who are found to be HIV infected, 53% were unaware of their HIV infection. So there's been remarkable progress. But nonetheless, that means that more than half of the people found to be HIV infected were unaware of their HIV infection. So that means we have a long way to go, even with this remarkable progress, to be able to, for people who are HIV infected, to be aware of their status. If you look at data from developed countries, these are data from the UK amongst MSM, and you can see over the years the change in the proportion who are diagnosed and treated in blue, in red diagnosed and untreated, and in green those who are undiagnosed. And you can see that over the years a substantial proportion, almost similar proportion, remains again undiagnosed. And if you look at the distribution of viral load amongst MSM in the UK, these are data from 2010, you can see that among those who have a higher viral load, this sector here of the pie, that most of them are those responsible for that are those who are undiagnosed. So again, there's a substantial need to expand HIV testing to identify those who are undiagnosed. In the United States, we also have further challenges. Not only do we have a huge MSM epidemic that's ongoing, but there's also disparity in terms of race, ethnicity. And from these data, from a national HIV behavioral surveillance studies, you will see that among those with HIV infection, a higher proportion of black, non-Hispanic MSM were unaware of their HIV infection. So we also have to expand testing, but we also have to engage specific subpopulations in order to achieve our goal of universal testing. The second challenge is in terms of late presentation with HIV. And these are data that are showing that over time, from 1991 actually to the present time, from these are data from developed countries, a pooled analysis of 44 studies, demonstrate there's been a very small increase in terms of the CD4, the mean CD4 at the time of diagnosis, from about 307 as a mean to maybe 350, I believe, is the number. So again, that we have a challenge in developed countries in terms of identifying people with earlier HIV infection, and this is obviously critical for individual benefit as well as for prevention purposes. And if we look at data from the U.S., from the HOPS study, we'll see again that if you look at this blue component, which are the individuals with less than 200 CD4 over time from 2000 to 2009, you'll see again the substantial proportion still of patients who are presenting to clinics in the United States have actually a CD4 less than 200 when they first present. And although we're seeing a bit of an increase in the higher CD4 strata, but nonetheless, again, late presentation, late identification of HIV infection. But these are data from clinics. What do we know about the distribution of CD4 in a population? These are data from SHIMS, a study that's funded by the CDC that we conducted in collaboration with the Ministry of Health in Swaziland. And this study was included a nationally representative sample of about 18,000 adults. And it was the purpose of the study was to determine the incidence and prevalence of HIV at a population level. I don't have time to go through the rather alarming rates of incidence in this study. But in a subset of the study, a subset of individuals with HIV were revisited and CD4 cell count was done amongst those individuals. And you can see here the population. This is a true population CD4 count distribution in Swaziland. And this is overall. And you can see that the majority of individuals had CD4 above 46% above 500, and the rest of the distribution, as you can see here. However, if you take out the people who report that they've been on ART and those who are not on ART, again, this is encouraging that at a population level, but 43% of the individuals had CD4 greater than 500, and 25% of them between 350 and 499. Again, indicating that if we are to expand HIV testing and reach individuals who are not getting access now, we're likely to find people with earlier HIV disease. However, there's good news. These are data that were collected through ICAP's support, working with the ministries of health in sub-Saharan Africa and funded through the CDC, that showed that over time, the median CD4 count at the time of enrollment in care, not an initiation of ART, has been increasing. And the proportion who are actually late enrollers is decreasing. So there's been progress. So there's been progress in terms of testing, and there appears to be progress, although slow progress, but still progress in terms of earlier enrollment into HIV care. Now, another challenge that I touched on is the HIV cascade, and this is a challenge both in sub-Saharan Africa but also around the world. And this is a pooled analysis of 29 studies that shows that of those who are tested, think of those as 100%, and those who are again here, CD4 measurement is available only in 72%. 40% of those are eligible for ART, and 25% of those individuals are initiated on antiretroviral therapy. So, of ART eligible patients, 62% have started antiretroviral therapy. So, we have a ways to go in terms of tightening and decreasing the gaps in the cascade. These are also data from Rwanda that has a very excellent HIV program. But again, you can see here from those who are tested, 42% only were enrolled within 90 days, and you can see the cascade thereafter. So the issue of linkage and the issue of retention in care and ART are huge challenges, and they challenge us in terms of how to collect the data, but also how to intervene to be able to enhance the gaps in this cascade. Now, once people are on antiretroviral therapy, again, this is another area where the data show us in 36 cohorts that over time there's a substantial attrition in terms of people in retention on ART programs. And I want to say that this is really no better than in developed countries, so I think we should be cognizant that actually the data are similar. Most of the data on retention in developed countries are from clinical trials, not from programs. So these are unusual data from sub-Saharan Africa. Now, what are the barriers to care and predictors of attrition? And it's really important for us to look at this very carefully and to listen to what the patients are telling us in terms of the barriers that they're facing. We can't dismiss those. Those are real issues. Major ones are economical issues, the transport costs, the distance from clinics, and these are being addressed largely by a massive effort at decentralization of services supported by PEPFAR and Global Fund where now services are being brought much closer to the community, but they need to go even further than where they're at now. I think the other issues are unable to take time from work, and then poverty and time constraints. Of course, there are other issues, psychosocial issues, that should not be dismissed, and these include stigma, fear of disclosure. Fear of drug toxicity is something that's very important, and I think that's particularly true in terms of asymptomatic individuals, as we're trying to treat more people who have no symptoms. Obviously, with taking a medicine, you're going to develop some symptoms, so we have to be cognizant of how we deal with that issue. And then the other issue that's really critical is the sense of an impediment is the perception of good health. There are other challenges as well that relate to the health systems, and those were mentioned again yesterday in terms of the long waiting lines, shortage of healthcare workers, and many others that I don't have time to address today. But there are many people are working on this in terms of task shifting, task sharing, community programs, and many, many other interventions. I'll focus a bit about the issue of early, trying to reach people who are earlier HIV disease. And here the concern, there are two concerns. One concern is our ability to retain people who are who don't have symptoms, who have early HIV infection. And these are data that show that when you look at retention in HIV care, this is pre-ART by initial CD4 cell count, you can see actually a really interesting gradient here that people with more advanced disease are much better able to be retained than those who have less advanced disease. Now, you may say this is in pre-ART, and maybe if you initiate ART, maybe they'll be retained better. That's a possibility, but that's a question that needs to be tested and looked at very carefully, and I think it's a challenge for us to develop interventions that help us achieve better retention. Again, data from that ICAP has worked on in collaboration with Ministry of Health in Rwanda and colleagues, and this is funded, again, through PEPFAR and CDC, that looks at loss to follow-up and mortality in pre-ART patients in Rwanda, and it's a large number, 31,000. And it's an excellent program, and you can see there by the loss to follow-up and mortality rates, which are really minuscule in terms of a programmatic in a large program. However, when we even look at pre-ART and loss to follow-up, you can see that there's the same gradient by CD4 cell count, that the sicker people are much better able to be retained than the healthier individuals. So this is telling us something very fundamental about how our programs are structured. And if you look at ART, again, in Rwanda, 17,000 individuals. Again, look at the loss to follow-up rates and the mortality. Again, remarkable data from the work of Rwanda and the people of Rwanda. You will see that, again, we see the same gradient. Even for those individuals on ART, there's the same gradient in terms of better retention, substantially, significantly better retention, the more advanced with more advanced HIV disease. Now, what about willingness to initiate antiretroviral therapy? And this is something important that we need to tackle very seriously. And this is one study that looked at this question. There have been very few studies that have looked at acceptability of ART, and particularly acceptability of ART for prevention. There's another study recently published with interesting qualitative data, but there are very few data. In this study, about 7,000 adults who were tested, about 35% of them were HIV infected, and about 29% of those, about 700 patients, were eligible for antiretroviral therapy. What's really interesting, and this is based on quite low thresholds, is that 20% refused to be referred for initiation of ART, and most actually refused again when they were offered referral for antiretroviral therapy. What is the most common reason for refusal? It was feeling well. So we have a challenge ahead of us in terms of, and this is not exclusive to antiretroviral therapy and HIV, the challenge of how do you engage people who are healthy or asymptomatic, taking pills and taking interventions for their own health or for prevention. Similarly, in 052, HPTN 052, when the study was unblinded and individuals who were not on ART were offered antiretroviral therapy, the numbers of individuals who declined antiretroviral therapy at 1 year and 1.5 years at follow-up, what are the reasons for that? And the majority of them, the reason was they believe their CD4 is too high. It may be possible that's because they were told this when they enrolled in the study, but nonetheless, again, we need to look at those reasons very carefully, and a lot of them have to do with feeling healthy, don't want to commit to lifetime treatment, fear of side effects, and so on. So these are areas that need research and need studies to be able to understand how we can intervene at those levels. So there's a huge research agenda that I call the how research agenda. And the how is, how do we do this? We need implementation science. We need studies that really guide us in terms of how do we achieve the goals we have in mind for ART as treatment or for ART as prevention. There are interesting insights, and there have been some studies that have been done. For example, there's exciting data that look at uptake of community HIV testing and counseling. A variety of methods have been used by testing the family of index patients, self-testing, mobile testing, door-to-door, workplace, school-based. So we need to expand the way we test, certainly by continuing to insist on provider-initiated counseling and testing and availability of voluntary counseling and testing. But we need to be creative and think about new ways to achieve coverage, to achieve testing at scale, while respecting, of course, the rights of individuals who are being offered the test. There are also novel approaches that have been identified. There are approaches, novel approaches for linkage and retention, like point-of-care CV4 testing, use of case managers, SMS, care bags, financial and transport incentives have been studied, and some have been shown to be efficacious. However, I believe that if we are to make a dent, if we are to achieve what we want to achieve, we need to have combination interventions. We need to think of intervention, multi-component interventions that focus at every part of the cascade, not just one, but every part of the cascade. So I believe that the use of multiple biomedical, structural, psychosocial interventions to address all of the complexities of barriers is what's needed in the future, and we desperately need a robust research agenda to be able to identify effective packages that can achieve our goals and objectives. We and others are involved in several implementation studies, and this is just examples of some of our work funded by NIH as well as by CDC and by USAID as well. And these are multi-component interventions that are looking at the cascade, this one being done in Swaziland, one in Mozambique, in Kenya, and elsewhere. And what we are trying to do is to have packages of interventions that have different types of interventions with the goal of enhancing the overall cascade, not one piece of the cascade. So I believe that if we are to tackle this cascade, we need to focus on the whole cascade. This is a piece that actually we put in as an opinion piece by actually my colleague Molly McNary, and we entitled it the HIV Continuum, No Partial Credit Given. And the idea is we should evaluate ourselves and our programs not by how well we do in terms of HIV testing or how well we do in terms of adherence, the two ends of this cascade, but we should give no partial credit. We should really be looking at assessing the whole cascade and evaluating ourselves, our work, our commitments, and programmatic success and performance based on the full evaluation of the cascade. This is not easy, but I think this is the challenge ahead of us. If we continue to focus on one only, we're not going to get where we want to get to. Now, do we have all the answers? So I mentioned the questions we have in mind, all of us have in mind, in terms of the how. What about the what? Do we have all the answers to the what? The critical question is, of course, efficacy and effectiveness. And all of you in this room appreciate that we have demonstrated the efficacy through HPTN-052 for ART for prevention, and we need now to keep on moving to try to demonstrate effectiveness so we can convince the world of our mission, our potential of this approach. One of the issues of concern is our key populations, and we heard about this morning and yesterday. And clearly, most of the studies, certainly HPTN-052 was done in serodiscordant heterosexual couples, and some of the ecological data have been based on some key populations, particularly amongst injection drug users. It was very interesting data that's been published as well as presented yesterday. However, we have to realize there's an increasing contribution by key populations to the HIV epidemic, and this is in sub-Saharan Africa. And you can see here that, again, injection drug users in blue, in some deep blue in some of the countries here, in Kenya, for example, MSM, substantially, again, increasing proportion of the new infections, sex work in green. So we have to also think about the issue of the efficacy in some of these key populations. Clearly, there's biological plausibility that no one will challenge, but nonetheless, we do have an agenda ahead of us to demonstrate efficacy in these populations and beyond that effectiveness. Why is that important? I think they're important because these epidemics in some of the ski populations are quite different and interesting and have lessons to teach us. These are data from Andrew Phillips on MSMs here in the UK. And in the UK, over the years, here in the dark dots are actual data and the gray are modeling results. You can see there's been an increase in the numbers of individuals on ART per year, substantial increase, the proportion with suppressed viral load over time. However, there's also been an increase in terms of the numbers of new infections per year. And you can see here again, in terms of incidence amongst in MSMs in this country, there's been an increase. Again, while there was a decrease early on, there's now been an increase over time in terms of the incidence of HIV. And what Andrew has shown is that also at the same time, there are many theories as to why that's happened, but it's possible that this was because of an increase here shown in condomless sex during this period of time. So we need to look at populations like amongst MSM in particular, and where there's a substantial proportion that's acute, anticipated to have acute infection as well, to look at the impact of ART, as well as the impact on on the effect of use of condoms or not use of condoms. These are data, I don't have time to go through them, but this is the actual, incidence, and through this modeling, the effect of no ART, there'll be about 70% increase in terms of incidence. With no condoms, there'll be a huge increase if you just stopped use of condoms. ART at diagnosis, there'll be about a 30% decrease. With higher testing rate, substantial decrease, and then with higher testing rate and ART at diagnosis, a substantial decrease in incidence. And I think the challenge is to then look also at the issue of what about in combination with different rates of condom use. There are also other challenges. We know that there's discordancy between the blood plasma HIV RNA levels and the seminal HIV RNA levels. And these are data that show in people who have suppressed virus in the bloodstream, the substantial proportion will have detectable, again, HIV in seminal fluid, and similar data have been shown in cervical secretions as well. So we need to look at this whole issue, and this comes up again and again in terms of what's the effect of ART, and the only way we measure the efficacy of ART is by looking at the blood, obviously, HIV RNA. These are areas of future research that are very important to tackle. And of course, critically, is the issue of the new infection, early infections and acute infections. And these are just data that show that there are very, very different estimates in terms of the proportion of new infections that are caused by early HIV infection. And you can see from as high as some of these studies here to as low as some of these studies down here. So this is, again, an unanswered question, and we need to look at this very carefully, especially in terms of in view of the fact that we don't have any simple, inexpensive, feasible diagnosis of acute HIV infection. And clearly, we don't identify these individuals so they don't get any ART for prevention. There are ongoing studies in key populations, and it's really important not to forget those populations. There's a study called the Partner Study amongst MSM being done in 75 European sites. And this is looking at serodiscordant, serodifferent MSM partnerships with the positive partner with less than 50 copies per ml viral load, but who do not use condoms. And the intent is to look at the risk of transmission in those partnerships as well as the reasons for lack of use of condoms. And about 1,000 couples have been enrolled, and it's ongoing enrollment. There's also HPTN-074, a Vanguard study that's now in development that's looking at injection drug users, a randomized, network-based randomized clinical trial amongst persons who inject drugs and their partners. And it's using, again, an integrated approach of facilitated antiretroviral therapy, substance use treatment, behavioral counseling. And the sites under consideration are in Eastern Europe and Asia, where the population is driven, the epidemic is largely driven by injection drug use. What about effectiveness? I think effectiveness is very critical. We have evidence of efficacy, and effectiveness is really what's the next frontier. There are several studies that are trying to look at various aspects of effectiveness, but probably there are three that I can point out to that have HIV incidence as the endpoint at a population level. This is the CDC-funded Botswana study, HPTN-071, the PEPFAR study funded through NIH, and from the PEPFAR, substantial funding from PEPFAR, and also from the Gates Foundation, and then the Africa Center study in KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa, funded by ANRS. The largest one, HPTN-071, is targeting a population of about 1.2 million individuals in about 21 communities and aims to enroll a population cohort of about 50,000 individuals to ascertain the incidence outcome. There are several other studies. There's a feasibility study by the HPTN-065 in the United States. There are other studies that are ongoing, this one by CDC in Tanzania and this one by NIH in Uganda. So I guess as we think about where we're at today in terms of ART for prevention and looking ahead in the future, I like this sign. It says silver bullet just ahead. We are hoping, we always hope, that there's a silver bullet that lies less ahead. But I think everybody in this room is quite pragmatic and also believes in the progress, the incremental progress, and the transformative progress of science. And then in all likelihood, we are not going to have a silver bullet, at least maybe not in my lifetime. But nonetheless, we have good tools at our fingertips, and we have to really utilize those tools appropriately and effectively and continue to seek answers to questions so we can utilize them appropriately and effectively. That's the key to having us better utilize the tools at hand. I believe very strongly that actually discovery needs to continue. We need to continue to look for efficacy. We need to continue to look for discovery. Because we have unanswered questions, the issue of the seminal fluid levels of HIV, the issue of looking at MSM in particular. But we also need to do implementation at the same time. Implementation is very important. Implement what we know. I think there's also, beyond implementation, there's a need for scale-up. We have to identify ways in which we can simply scale up interventions and identify simple packages that can be scaled up. I do think, though, that it's a loop, and that through the implementation and through scale-up, we are identifying new questions, and those new questions have to go back into discovery mode to motivate new research that can be done either through discovery phase or through implementation science. I also believe in that ART for prevention is a multi-component integrated strategy. It's not one intervention. It includes expansion of testing and all the complexities entailed in that. It includes linkage and all the complexities entailed in that, includes retention, includes adherence interventions. So it's not one intervention. It's a package of interventions. And we need to think about it this way and actually think of our research agenda as a very broad agenda that's looking at a very complex strategy that has a lot of moving pieces that all need to move together at the same time with high fidelity and with high efficacy. I think it's thinking of ART for prevention in this manner that we can achieve the goals for both prevention as well as also for treatment for the benefit of people who are treated. And ultimately, in conclusion, I think whatever drives our programs, whatever drives our research should be guided by very simple principles of increasing access, of course, to services and programs, ensuring there's high acceptability and thinking about acceptability by the populations that we take care of, that we want to take care of, achieving high quality of the programs, achieving coverage, which is ultimately how we achieve public health impact, and very importantly, demonstrating and measuring effectiveness. And thank you very much for your attention.